Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sports Community with your hosts, Joe Novella and Steve Pallas. Steve, hello to you, my friend. How are you?
Joe, as normal, we get to the time where we record the show and, geez, I'm exhausted. I don't know whether it's because of all the sport that's going on or whether it's I've got two kids, I've got three kids, but two under two that don't seem to sleep at night, Joe.
We have got an absolute belter of a show for everyone out there today. So stick around while we talk to you about grassroots sports, and we got some fantastic guests. We got Lauren from Social Media Services, who's going to talk to us all about social media and how it should be used at clubs. Some of the things that she's going to talk about are things that you should include and things that you should avoid. So it's going to be very much well worth your listening to. We're also going to be talking top nine tips for cash and asset protection at your club. So make sure you stick around and listen to that. That's going to be very important. Steve's going to talk to you about how to protect the cash and the assets at your club and to stop all that you stole this, no, you didn't steal this kind of argument that seems to be the scourge of local grassroots sporting clubs. In the meantime, just a bit of current affairs, mate. I want to talk about some of the racism issues that seems to have poked their ugly heads up again over the last week. And the two that particularly come to mind are a particular owner of an NBA franchise, as they're called, the Clippers, and his remarks in regards to bringing along coloured people to games, which has sparked an absolute uproar in the US. And also over the weekend, a Barcelona footballer was thrown a banana as he was about to take a corner, and he had the greatest response. He picked the banana up, peeled it, ate it, and then took the corner. But nonetheless, the act of throwing a banana, and this guy is a dark skinned fella, so obviously the banana is in ape reference, which we don't want or don't condone now. Mate, in terms of our local clubs, what is, in a nutshell, what is the best way that we can educate ourselves on making sure that this doesn't happen to us at our local clubs?
Yeah, Joe, challenging topic, isn't it? And I guess there's two parts to it. First of all, is creating a culture that just doesn't allow that sort of behaviour in the first instance, and then in the second instance, if and when it does occur, how do we deal with it? And we're seeing a lot of clubs now taking a very strong stance, and sport in general taking a very strong stance on all sorts of human rights issues. And we've just seen in the last 2 weeks with the major sporting codes in Australia have all committed to stamping out homophobia, for instance. But interestingly, with the LA Clippers example that I found inspiring was that the players of the team made a stance.
Yes.
And that's something that we're seeing changing now, is that good people are no longer standing by.
Absolutely.
And allowing that to continue, allowing that the behaviour to go unchecked. Unresponded to. And I find, you know, in the LA Clippers scenario, or the response of the players, who were, you know, a predominantly African American team, you know, to take off their training, or their warm up uniform, and throw it on the logo of the Clippers logo in the middle of the court was very symbolic of saying, hey, we don't accept this. And it's interesting, or not interesting, but the play by the rules are just finalising some research now, which we hope to get Peter Downs back onto the show soon, who's the CEO of Play by the Rules, about what should we do in a scenario a club scenario, what should happen when we hear a remark or a behaviour that is completely unacceptable and offensive. Now, whether it's racism or homophobia or all sorts of other human rights conversations that we're very proudly have moved on from, or move towards something that's a lot more respectable, it's still happening. And so I look forward to talking to Peter about what we should be doing, what we can be doing as the person that just happens to be next to that situation as it unfolds. Because for lots of people, that can be really, really intimidating.
Absolutely. And look, it's a topic that's well worth discussion, because Australia is increasingly diversifying its population. There are people from all different cultures, creeds, races, and nationalities coming into our sports clubs. And we have to learn to deal with that. And we have to learn to make sure that those people feel included. And there is zero tolerance to anything that might encourage racism of any sort. And, you know, we just hope that these examples of racism at the very top levels start to abate, because I definitely don't want to see it. So, interesting, and we look forward to having Peter Downs on the show.
Yeah, just while we wrap up that session, Joe, the thing that makes me, that inspires me, is that scenarios are happening, but we're now as a society no longer accepting them and moving on without them being addressed. So I think that's the thing, the key learning out of this week and the scenarios, particularly around the LA Clippers, is that that we need to make a stand about what's acceptable and not acceptable.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Joe Novella and Steve Pallas. If you've missed a couple of our episodes, why not visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au. And there you'll find all our previous podcasts that you can download. And while you're there, give us a review so you can help spread the news about Sports Community and its services to the grassroots sports clubs.
You're on RPP 98.7 and 98.3 on the Peninsula.
Welcome back to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Joe Novella and Steve Pallas. We've got a very special guest with us today. Her name is Lauren Bartley. She's a social media consultant, educator, coach, public speaker and blogger, an early adopter and self-confessed geek. Welcome to the show, Lauren.
Thanks a lot for that.
No worries.
Lauren, it's Stephen here. Thank you very much for coming on the show. I first had the pleasure of listening to you speak about social media when we were talking to the sports clubs of La Trobe Uni, which seems a fair while ago now.
Yes, great to meet you there.
Yeah, it was a great session with some very new administrators just coming into the world of sports administration. So thanks very much for coming on to the show. We're going to talk social media today, and social media means a lot of things to a lot of people. So before we worry about what it means to sports clubs, Lauren, what does social media mean to you?
Well, social media is where people hang out these days. It's where people communicate with their friends. It's where they find out what they want to do with their day, how they spend their time. It's really like real life, but online. And as part of that, it's not just the technology itself, it's the content and the experiences that people have in an online environment.
Absolutely. So if in a summary, when clubs are, when you're talking to clubs, and I know you spend a lot of time talking to grassroots sports clubs, why do you so passionately believe that they should be on social media or participating in social media?
Yeah, well, basically because it's where their idol audience is hanging out. And I know a real issue with clubs these days is attracting and retaining members.
Yes.
And this provides a communication channel in order to access those potential members and also to activate their current members. So to get them more involved in other roles and other positions within the club environment. And then also to reward your volunteers, because quite often we'll have within sport, you know, it's a sunk cost job. And if we can use public forums like this to be able to promote the great work that individuals are doing, it gives them, you know, they feel warm and fuzzy and appreciated for what they're contributing to the club environment.
Oh, absolutely. We're forever talking to clubs about recognising and rewarding the volunteers, because that's how you get a culture of ongoing volunteering.
Yep.
When we talk social media, I mean, that's a bit of a buzzword and a bit of a catch-all type of phrase, but what does social media actually mean? When we talk social media, what are we actually talking about from platforms and sites and those sorts of things?
Yeah, okay. So it's, well, the platforms are really, they're just the social media tools. So, you know, we've got Facebook, which, you know, has got more than 1.3 billion people use it, that use it worldwide. And I think it's getting close to 12 million Australians that are using it these days. That's kind of like the big juggernaut of social media. But then we've also got things like Twitter, which is quite often used in sport as well, particularly when they're, you know, updating scores and that kind of thing, the real time, if people want to know what's happening in the news as it's breaking. YouTube's great from a sporting perspective in terms of being able to, you know, demonstrate skills and also really showcase things like your coaches. I've seen a lot of sports that are using YouTube to, let's say, a tennis coach, for example, who is putting up a whole heap of different ways to perform, the serves, the volleys, the different techniques. And, you know, if you're interested in tennis or looking into getting into tennis, then you can go and search YouTube on how to play. You see that this particular coach is, you know, an expert in it. He might be the one that you then contact to see if you can come down and get some tuition off him. So, you know, platforms like that. LinkedIn, not so much, maybe from a recruitment point of view in terms of finding coaches and seeing who's out there. Instagram's one that's taken off as well, and that's a real visual medium where you can take photos or 15-second videos, and there's a lot of movement towards Instagram, particularly with the younger demographic these days. So it's something that I find that perhaps the sports aren't using a lot, but perhaps their audience is there. And then there's other things as well, like Google Plus and Pinterest and Foursquare, and I mean the list goes on. You know, Snapchat's another one that is quite popular amongst the youth these days. And then even blogging platforms like Tumblr, that even comes into the mix. So that's, I suppose, in terms of the platform side of things. But I actually think social media to go beyond just the social side of it as well. It's the integration of it within websites and emails and other forms of digital communication that an organisation might use.
Cool. Well, that's a lot. I might just go backwards a couple of steps, because we have a huge number of people in our audience that don't use social media and to a degree don't understand what it is. So if I run you through, I was frantically taking notes as you were speaking there. So if I run you through each of those applications that you listed there, can you just give our listeners a really brief, assuming that they haven't used these applications before, just a really brief summary of what each is and when in a sporting context or in a club context we would use that application more so than in another. So if in a very short summary, what we'll start with the big elephant in the room. What is Facebook for those that haven't actually used it before?
Okay, so Facebook is the number one social media network in terms of what people use. Most people these days have a Facebook account or have at least had some exposure to it. I think the main application of Facebook from a sporting perspective, or the main challenge that people have with that, is they're like, okay, we know we need to be on Facebook, but how? What do we need to do? And it's interesting. I quite often see we've got sporting clubs that will set up a page. So that's like a public profile for their sporting club to promote what it is that they do, you know, as part of that whole attracting people to their club and promoting the different things, the activities that are coming up. Pages are quite good for that. And what pages, there's actually a type of page sporting organisations can set up. Groups also work really well for clubs. So a club can set up a group on Facebook, and in doing that, it allows the members within that group, within the club, to have an online forum in which they can discuss. And you can either set that group up as being public, private, or a secret group. Now, a secret group, I wouldn't suggest that, because everyone has to be friends to invite each other into the group. So, you know, you might not want to be friends with your president on Facebook, that kind of thing. So a closed group works really well, because anyone can find the group, but you have to request to join, and then
the admin of that group will approve it. A public group, which I see a lot of clubs choose to have a public group as well, that comes with a little bit, I see that as a potential issue because people might be posting there thinking that they're safe within the confines of their group, but anyone can search for that group and see the discussions going on within that group. So I tend to say that if a club's going to set up a group, that they want to do that and make it a private group. But I don't think a private group alone is enough because that's great. It services the current members. But think of this, if I'm coming to Facebook for the first time and I look up my local, you know, soccer club and I say, okay, I want to join this group and I request to join the group and then the admin goes, oh, you're not a member, I'm going to deny your request. That's not a great first exposure to that particular club and it may prevent me then from joining it. I think I've been rejected already just because you wouldn't let me in your Facebook group.
Yeah.
So I think groups have a purpose for the current memberships, but I don't think they're sufficient. I think the page is more relevant. And then the other thing that happens is we have clubs that say, oh, I'll just set myself up as a friend and everyone can be my friend on Facebook. And that has privacy issues around whoever's the... It's not known who the administrator of that group is. And once you become a friend relationship on Facebook, you're actually sharing a lot of your personal details. And it's probably not appropriate that the club have that level of access into the lives of all of their club members. So I would suggest set up a page if you're a club. Consider a group if you've got the capacity to do that as well. But don't go down the path of setting up a profile. If you have set up a profile, you can convert it to being a page. So, but and then what you do is you post in content which appears in your timeline and then it goes out into the news feed of all of the people that have liked your page or are members of your group if you've set either of them up. So it becomes a really good way to communicate to your members and potential members, but it's not, Facebook is not, we put all our information on there and then everyone sees it. Facebook actually has algorithms that it applies to what ends up in people's news feeds. So you can't just assume because it's on Facebook all our members will know about it because they've liked our page or they're in our group. So that's probably one of the things that a lot of clubs aren't aware of. And I have seen in the past that people say, oh, we don't need to put on our website because it's on Facebook. Your website's still your home base and your website still should be the main portal for all the information that you share around your club. And then you further promote that via the social media channels, but they shouldn't be the be-all and end-all.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So Facebook, I guess, is your public notice board. Then what is Twitter then?
Yep. Okay. Oh, just one thing on that. I don't think it's your public notice board. It's an engagement tool. It's just a bit of a bugbear I have with a lot of people who promote. They kind of broadcast. I think you need to engage. And that's not just Facebook. That's on all of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Twitter is more of your microblogging type of platform. So there's a 140 character limit on that. And you can embed within a tweet, you can have photos, videos, links, and other rich media content. And in the same way that you can within Facebook. And so basically people will see that in their news feed on Twitter. And it's quite fast paced. So if people are following a lot of people on Twitter, quite often the lifespan of a tweet might only be, you know, 30 minutes. On Facebook, the lifespan of a post is about 3 hours. And again, that varies depending upon how many pages they've liked or how many people they're friends with, that kind of thing. But within Twitter, you can obviously set up lists and follow hashtags and do other things so that you can have more control over the kind of content that you're seeing in your newsfeed and so that you're not missing stuff. So, for example, I might set up a close friends list or my sporting interest list or something like that and follow that list on Twitter. A lot of people do that. But where Twitter really comes into its own is kind of in the real time and the live event space. So it's great, as I said before, for score updates, and it's also really good for connecting people. So let's say I'm at an event and I'm using the event hashtag and I see someone else is using the event hashtag, and then, you know, we can communicate backwards and forwards via that and maybe actually meet up in real life. So it's a different beast, and as that it attracts a different audience. Your Facebook is kind of an everyone kind of audience, and whereas a lot of people, when they look at Twitter, they just scratch their heads and go, oh, that's just a bit hard. It's probably just slightly more men will use Twitter, whereas Facebook, slightly more female demographic. And it's usually Twitter is kind of, it ranges, it's a bell curve, but, you know, it's kind of your 20 to 35 age group.
Yeah, I didn't realise that, but yep. That makes sense. YouTube. You mentioned YouTube and how coaches were using that to show videos. So YouTube clearly then is linked to videos?
Yes. So YouTube is effectively a search engine for videos where people post their videos to YouTube, and then it's actually the number two search engine behind Google. It's also owned by Google, and it's as a result, if you Google something, quite often you'll get some videos that will come up, and you can actually, when you're Googling something, choose to only Google videos as well. So it requires a Google Plus account to set up to activate a channel, which isn't too hard to do. But what happens is people, they'll like videos, they'll comment on videos, they'll share videos. You can subscribe to a YouTube channel, and you can also embed videos. And so a lot of people will take the videos that someone else has created and, let's say, embed them in a blog post or something they create. So that's another way that you can actually get more reach for your content, because if it's coming up well high in search engines and people think, oh, this is really good content, I'd like to embed this into one of my blog posts, then obviously everyone that reads that content is being exposed to your video as well. So that can have benefits in terms of greater awareness of whatever it is that you're either, you know, if you're a coach demonstrating in your video, or maybe you're promoting something, or just giving useful information that will make people think highly of you.
Yeah, fantastic. So then the other one that you mentioned was Instagram.
Yeah.
I just want to run us quickly through Instagram. But one of the things I'm interested in as well when we talk about Instagram is, when would I use Instagram compared to Facebook, and Facebook compared to Instagram?
Okay, great. Yeah, well, I love Instagram personally. people respond to images, and that's the same on Facebook. You know, people will see images and they'll engage with them, and you know, it's a really rich media. You know, a picture tells 1,000 words. And so basically, Instagram, you can share images and also up to 15-second videos. And so, but what it does and why I suppose it's a bit of fun is that you can actually apply filters and other image editing tools to the images that you create. And then what happens is it basically can make anyone with their mobile phone a photographer. Or at least think they're a photographer. And then you can use descriptions and hashtags and apply geolocation. So a geolocation basically tells people where that image was taken. And then, and I actually didn't mention this before on Twitter, but obviously hashtags are massive on Twitter. People can search for content using those hashtags, which is another way of being found. It doesn't have any links, so you can't, put a link and draw people back to your website or that type of thing. And it is mobile only, so it's not. You can view it from a desktop device, but you can't actually upload videos to a desktop. And just to give you an example, when you said how would you use this in conjunction to something like Facebook or Twitter, one of the beauties of Instagram is that when you take an image on Instagram, you can actually push it out to Facebook and Twitter if you wanted to do it that way. It does drag people back to Instagram to view the image. What it actually does when you take a photo is it saves it to your camera roll on your phone. And so then, because you can make a nice image using the filters on Instagram, it saves it to your camera roll. And then you can just jump into Facebook and share that directly within Facebook as though you're posting it, and it's just a better image. Oh. So that's where, it becomes useful in just creating more engaging images to share on the other platforms as well.
Oh, okay, so it's not just the display tool but a production tool as well, which is really important for clubs, because it's really taking away that need to have that professional expertise, isn't it? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely. And there's loads of other apps as well that you can use to do that. And I'm a bit of an app junkie because, you know, I just love creating images that, you know, are a bit different and unique. And, you know, there's little things like I use InstaWeather, and I've seen this used before from a club environment where, you know, you take a photo of the sporting ground, and then you just put an overlay on it that says 42 degrees, you know, and it has the location of yep. your particular club. And so instead of putting a post on Facebook that says training's cancelled tonight because it's too hot,
yep.
you put this image up of your clubhouse and the actual temperature, and, you know, it's just more engaging. People are more likely to interact with it because it's more interesting. It'll catch their attention in the newsfeed rather than just seeing text flying by.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, if a club's we strongly encourage clubs to engage in social media because this is where people to use what you were saying. This is where people are hanging out these days online. Before a club goes down that path, they need to think about some of the policies that they should have in place. So, when we talk social media policy, or when you talk social media policy to a club, what are you saying that a social media policy is, and then what should be included in that?
Yep, okay. Well, I think the first thing that they need to do is look at what the systems are going to be in place for monitoring and moderation, because that's the thing that everyone all of a sudden, you know, as soon as we hear social media, they go, oh, no, but, you know, we could have trolls and we could have this and we could have that.
Yeah.
But the reality is that most people behave nicely.
Yeah, exactly.
But yes, you do have the exceptions. So you need to prepare yourself for those exceptions. And your policy should include some details just that provide the framework as to how people should, you know, respond and escalate. So what's the overall monitoring policy going to be? You know, are you going to check it daily? Is it going to be weekly? Is it going to, you know, who's going to be doing that? And then look at giving them some sort of, whoever that person is that, or people that are going to be monitoring whichever platforms you're on, give them some sort of a flow chart in terms of, you know, how do we monitor, then we evaluate, how do we, what's the guidelines around how we respond, and in what cases would we remove the post, you know, and then when do we escalate this, at what point? Because that's what, you know, often people will be given, let's say we've gone on, you know, the coach of the under-19 team, he's good on Facebook, we'll give him the job, and then just leave them to his own device. He might see something which he thinks is perfectly fine and therefore doesn't do anything about it. But if he's given some guidelines around what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, then in that same instance he might have gone, actually, I think that's okay, but I don't think that the president will be too happy with that. So my policy says that when I'm, you know, unsure, or, you know, I'm at least querying whether or not this is appropriate, that I need to contact the secretary. And then the secretary does whatever, you know, reviews it or whatever. So you develop the policy around who the appropriate people are and who does what in that circumstance. And then also provide those people with some level of training. So you can't just say, oh, they know how to use, you know, Twitter. So we'll give them Twitter.
Yes.
Because Twitter, when you're representing your club, is different to how you use Twitter when you're representing yourself. And I do believe you should use social media in a social way and as individual to individual, not necessarily club to individual. Yes, you're representing the club, but you should have there should be a certain... the club should have a persona, if that's what to say. So the club should have certain types of language that they use that's appropriate and what's not appropriate, a certain tone that they use, you know, certain branding that you're using in the images that you're uploading, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you want some guidelines around those things. And then I suppose the authority represents another one that's important. So at what point this comes from the personal profiles as well, and I know this is quite becomes within sport when we have people that are in positions of authority within the club, that they might be using their own social media account and saying things like, you know, abusing the referee's decision or those types of things. Yeah, they're acting as their own, you know, but everyone knows that they are the president of the club. So it's actually not appropriate, even up through their own communication channel, that they be, you know, they be acting in that way in the public space. So I think you definitely need to look not only at how they're using your social media, but also how they're using their own. And then I suppose the one thing that kind of a lot of clubs overlook is the consistency with their current policies. So just because we're on social media doesn't mean we have to go and write a whole heap of new policies. You might have an overarching social media policy or guidelines that you develop, but you need to look at your other policies, like, you know, around a respect and
privacy. Codes of conduct, yeah.
Yeah, the harassment, child protection, discrimination, all those things. You know, even like crisis management. Crisis management, whether it happens online or offline, should be, you know, there should be similar processes that you deal with it. And if someone misbehaves online, then it's your disciplinary and grievance procedure that you go back to. You don't, you shouldn't require a different one for social media.
Absolutely, it should bundle in. Now, let's just take that. Sport is a very emotional, emotional time. So inevitably, something will a person responsible for your social club's social media will post something that's inappropriate, and we've seen examples of that in clubs as large as Manchester United and this Cricket Australia, even over the last summer with the English touring team have posted unacceptable posts. So in the world of social media, once it's up, it's up. So then how should clubs respond when they find that there is a post that's been deemed unacceptable or is unacceptable?
Well, first of all, you made a really good point there when you said when it's up, it's up. I mean, digital media, whilst you can go and delete things, you should be treating it as though it's written in stone. You know, even if you go and delete a post because you think, oh, we shouldn't have done that, let's delete it. You don't know where it's been screenshot. You don't know who's reshared it or, you know, where else it's going to end up. So I suppose the first thing is, you know, you should, if you're not prepared for it to be on the, you know, the 7 o'clock news, then don't post it in the first place. Have guidelines around that. And when something is inappropriate, then if it's come from within your own channels and you can delete it, then yes, I would delete it. And if you know that it's already had a bit of traction, then you'd probably want to put a statement out there in regards to it. If it's something that, you know, has been up there for 5 seconds and no one seems to have noticed it, then yeah, by all means, you might not make a song or dance about it and see what happens. If it's something that's come that's outside of your own channel, so let's say it's, you know, like I mentioned before, the president has said something on their own personal account, then you'll need to deal with that on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, like anything, if someone does something that you don't think is appropriate, then you approach them, you ask them, you know, you perhaps suggest that they might take that down, and perhaps they will. In some cases, they won't. In some cases, they will just keep going. And that's when your disciplinary and grievance procedures really need to come into it, and as to how you would react to that.
Absolutely. Another area that is causing a lot of confusion for people just coming into social media, and for those that have been in it for quite a long time, actually, is the usage of photos and videos. And you've kind of said through this interview that photos say 1,000 words. So what is the well, I guess there's two things, isn't there? There's the law, and then there's what's acceptable as well, which may be slightly different in some cases.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing because we don't have, like, the right to privacy around, you know, our personal images. There's no laws around that in Australia. And, you know, there's things like, you know, invasion of privacy and that. But from the perspective of taking images, it's really hard for someone to, you know, say that I want you to take that, to press charges because you've taken an image of them. You know, if it's something like defamation where, you know, someone's reputation is on the line, or if you're doing something that's untoward, so, you know, let's say you're taking photos of people in a half undressed and provocative state, well then, you know, those types of things, they would probably have, you know, due course to come back and take legal proceedings. But if you're just taking general pictures of, let's say, you know, if I'm taking photos of my son on the weekend at a soccer club and I'm posting that on my personal profile, there really isn't much that the individuals can do about that from a legal point of view. It comes back more to a common sense approach and a what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And so from a personal point of view, if I take photos of my kids' soccer team and post them on my page, then legally I can do that. But whether or not the other parents are going to be happy about that is another thing and a conversation that, you know, probably needs to take place. From the club's point of view, you'd want to formalise that if that's your intention. So if your intention is to take the photos and then put them on the Facebook page, then it's just, you go down a similar process of what they do if, you know, at school where they ask permission of the to take photos and include it on, you know, websites or social media or those types of things. And a lot of clubs are now integrating that within their registration forms when people sign up. So that's probably the best place to capture it. That's great, you know, what the club secretary gets that information, but does the coach know that that's not permitted? So it's, you know, if someone says that they don't want it because perhaps they've, you know, got restraining order on somewhere and they've relocated and they don't want, you know, to be found or something like that. So it's a real grey area. Unfortunately, the law doesn't really help the people that don't want to be photographed in public places. So it's really, I'd just say it comes back to a common sense approach and to try and protect people by, you know, requesting their permission. Where it does become, from the legal perspective, is when you start using things for commercial purpose and whether or not a sporting club would be considered commercial purpose if you're just putting it up, you know, showing the team, you know, the regular team photo, I wouldn't think so. But if you're actually doing like a paid advertisement and you're using that image, then you actually should be getting a model release from those people that are involved in those photographs.
Plenty to think about as clubs delve into social media. Lauren, thank you so much for your time. We could talk for hours, and hopefully over the next year or so, we will talk for hours over a number of different episodes if you'll have us back.
Definitely.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been fantastic and brilliant, and I've learned a lot. So hopefully our clubs will as well.
Thank you. It's been great being involved.
Hi, I'm Jack, and my dad is Pete from the Mornington and Rosebud Chelsea stores. My dad has been really busy lately helping customers get the right home bundle, internet and mobile phone plans. But it's not just my dad. All the staff are really friendly and ready to help. So drop in and see the team at Telstra store in Mornington and Rosebud.
Or call us on 1300-MY-TELSTRA. That's 1300-698-357.
And in the meantime, I'm off to kick the footy with Dad.
Hey Jack, kick it to me.
A station sponsor.
No matter what the news.
Heard an almighty bang.
It hit so fast.
The ground was shaking.
Local.
People running up and down screaming.
There was grass everywhere.
I can't believe this is happening.
National.
Australia's drought is over.
He is now the Wizard of Oz.
International.
There it is. A fantastic game.
Are we ready?
Magnificent.
It was a dream come true.
Hear it all on RPFM.
Dreaming of a place which is abundant with fresh fruits, herbs and vegetables, cheeses, seafood, bread, cakes and many other regional delicacies? Well, stop dreaming, as the Farmers Market in Mornington has all that and a whole lot more. Enjoy freshly made coffee and ready-to-eat food in an environment which the kids will love. Open every second Saturday of every month from 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. $2 per adult. Children are free. The Farmers Market Mornington, our station sponsor.
More and more people with a taste for quality are shopping at Eliza Meats. Kevin and his lean team pride themselves on the finest cuts. From juicy steaks and roasts to high-grade mince and sausages. And Eliza Meats are the gourmet specialists. Inquire about Eliza Meats Spit Hire. Phone 9787 4473 for a mouth-watering meal fit for a king. It's all at Eliza Meats. See our sponsor Kevin at Eliza Meats, 112B Mount Eliza Way, a station sponsor.
It's the weekend, the footy's on, the big men are flying, and you need something to satisfy that hunger. Baked In is the real deal. Baked In have a range of mouth-watering, piping hot pies, scrumptious gluten-free cakes and breads. Three locations, Sorrento, Portsea and Blairgowrie. Never far away from the action, Baked In is an RPPFM sponsor.
This is Sally from Sweet Pea Cuisine. At Sweet Pea Cuisine, we specialise in sharing knowledge, passion and enjoyment around food. We run cooking classes for kids, teens and adults, present food events and cooking demonstrations, create recipes to highlight your product and style food for the camera. Join me every Tuesday morning on the breakfast program when I chat about all things food on the peninsula. To find out more, visit me at www.sweetpeacuisine.com.au and like my Facebook page, Sweet Pea Cuisine. Stay sweet with Sweet Pea Cuisine, a station sponsor.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Steve Pellis and Joe Novella, another Sports Community digital production, courtesy of www.sportscommunity.com.au. Joe and Steve here on Sports Community, helping grassroots clubs succeed. We've got our ever-popular Top 9 segment for you today, and today's Top 9 is Top 9 Tips for Cash and Asset Protection Tips for Your Club. Now, given your financial services background, Steve, I would imagine this is right up your alley.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. It is a little bit. Well, it's very near and dear to my heart because it's almost the elephant in the room when we're talking to clubs, isn't it? We're quite brutal in our training and in our advice to clubs, saying that if you don't introduce processes and procedures that protect your cash, then it will be stolen. It's not a matter of if; it's just a matter of when. And it's so sad. We say that in every training session that we're dealing with these sort of topics. And inevitably, Joe, inevitably, at the end of a training session or even during that session, someone or more than one person, but always someone, will come up to us and tell us a story of either their club or a club that they know or a person that they know. So,
And the after effects are absolutely catastrophic, aren't they? And it might be a very, very small or insubstantial amount of cash, but it can just wreak havoc on the reputation and the brand of the club and its ability to attract committee members. And so it is one that people don't like to talk about, but it is so important.
Yeah, look, and to me, protecting the cash is the second most important thing, Joe. The most important thing is to protect the people that are holding that are handling the cash, because we've seen again the damage that comes from people being accused of misappropriating or stealing funds when in fact that they haven't. But the procedures around that person and the cash handling wasn't able to prove that. And so the most important part about putting good, strong cash management procedures, yes, it protects the cash, but more importantly, it protects the people handling the cash. So, Joe, let's without
launch
any,
into it.
We'll get off our soapbox and
yep.
we'll get down
number
to
one,
it.
Number one, minimise the amount of cash not physically located in your club's bank account.
Well, it's common sense, isn't it? If it's in the bank, it's a lot harder to be stolen. So traditionally, sports clubs have been cash economies, and everything's been paid in cash and received in cash, and that just doesn't need to be the case anymore, Joe. Like, you think of your memberships, clubs can now facilitate the sale of memberships online, so the money just goes from the individual's bank account or the member's bank account into the club's bank account, so it's not actually at the club premises at any stage. Same with event ticket sales. Now, it could be presentation night, Joe. It could be the season launch. It could be social function. It could be the cocktail party. It could be any function where you're selling tickets. Well, there's no need to just have the only way that tickets are sold today being pay us money over the bar or pay us money at the club. There's online ticket sales are very, very popular. And again, they limit the amount of money that's floating around the club, and I think that's a really, really important thing. And just before we move off this one, Joe, sadly, one thing that can't happen is at the end of a big club function to leave the money in the club overnight, which creates a lot of challenge and a lot of concern for some clubs, because we could be looking at $10,000+, and what do you do with that money at 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning when of course the banks are shut and the concept of a night bank is no longer available to us. So most clubs think it's the best thing to do is to hide the money somewhere within the club rooms. But it is amazing how many times we hear of clubs being knocked off or robbed on the night of the big function. So it's absolutely okay for people to take money home as long as more than one person, the president, the treasurer, whoever, the vice president, secretary, know exactly how much money has been taken, and the person taking it will be the person banking it first thing Monday morning, so that they, more than one person know how much money that person's got, and they have the ability to check to come Monday morning that money's sitting in the bank account. So that's really important. And again, if it's a large amount of money, because some clubs have these massive functions, Joe, where you could be having... And we had a fundraising, we were involved in a fundraising function ourselves not long ago where that had over $50,000 cash just on the night. Well, maybe that's too much for one person to be taking home from a safety point of view. So split that money between some trusted people, but know who's got what and when it's going to be banked. So tip number one, and common sense will prevail, limit or minimise the amount of cash at your club, Joe.
Tip number two, ensure cash is kept secure while at your club.
Yeah, and again, these are very common sense rules, and we're talking about the use of cash registers and the uses of safes, but also think about a normal canteen scenario or a normal bar scenario within a club. Not just protect the cash in a secure location, but limit the number of people that can enter those locations. Make sure it's only those people that are authorised to be there, and limit the number of people that are authorised.
Mm.
Because if something goes wrong and cash does go missing, well, it's a lot harder to track if there's a large number of people. Or on the other side of the coin, if it's a very small number of people that are handling the cash, then that actually acts as a very strong deterrent, because there's not grey area and ambiguity. So again, making sure that while the cash isn't your club rooms, that it is kept in a completely safe, secure environment with restricted access.
And clearing it regularly, of course.
Yeah, if you're clearing your cash registers very regularly and taking the money to a safe, and out of the public viewing, and just taking the opportunity away from people is a very strong deterrent as well.
Okay, number three, ensure there is a process for incoming payments.
Now, this is this sounds common sense, Joe, and in that we should be able to account for all the money that comes into a sports club. But I'll just give you a quick scenario that might make it a little bit more complex. If we've got a game of it could be anything, let's call it a hockey game, where there's people coming in, pay at the gate to come into the game, and they've got canteens and they've got bars and that sort of thing. So you could have a scenario where at the start of the day you've got a pool of money, you give some to the gatekeepers, you give some to the canteen, you give some to the bar, you give some to the guys that are going to sell the raffle during the day. During the day, you might then also have the butcher come in who wants to deliver sausages to the canteen who needs to be paid. The bar's run out of cash, so you need to give them more money. The raffle guys have sold their tickets, so then all of a sudden you've got money coming back in. You've got the bar sales coming in. You've got the canteen sales coming in. The end of the day, we might pay some of the referees and umpires out of the cash. We might have some player payments or player rewards or some awards. So at the end of the day, we've completely lost track of what money relates to what activity. And that is the first and foremost scenario where money goes missing, is when we don't track it, we don't control it, and we don't account for it. So it's not easy to create a process that controls the cash, but certainly one that allows for proper accounting, a proper recording, proper receipting, and proper payments of your cash payments and receipts as they happen is vital, Joe, as a really strong A, control, B, protection, and C, deterrent.
Yeah, and I think that kind of melds into our next point, which is ensuring incoming funds attract.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's attract, I mean, and tracked and recorded and accounted for, because under the Incorporated or the different associations acts, I mean, it's the responsibility of the committee to record and report all cash financial transactions. So it's not just good enough to record match day receipts when they could relate to gate takings and bars and canteens and merchandise sales and memorabilia sales and raffle sales. We need to account for those properly. And that accounting process actually forms a really strong protective process, Joe.
Yeah, absolutely, including, if possible, a reconciliation process.
Well, yes, that's a really good point. And gate sales are a really good example of that, where if you have tickets, you know how many tickets you've given out to people coming in, and it should be very easy to equate the number of tickets to the amount of cash that you hold. If you don't have tickets, or you don't have a way of doing that, of reconciling that, then how do you know that the cash you're holding at the end of the day is all there? And so just those simple processes of creating that reconciliation process is really good. And that can be collecting money from different points around the ground and those sorts of things as well.
Okay, number five is ensuring there is a process for outgoing payments.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we see often, Joe, is that the clubs, they just pay the bills as they come in. And probably worse than that, one person is responsible for getting the invoice, receiving the invoice and signing the check. So what we're saying is the clubs should have strong budgetary processes. If something's within that budget process, well then, yeah, it should be paid. If it's outside that budget amount, it needs to get the approval of the committee. But either way, two people should approve those payments, not just a single person, whether it's a cheque or EFT payments.
Number six is ensuring outgoing payments are tracked.
Yeah, and this is, again, consistent with what we were talking about with the receipting, Joe. We're making sure that every transaction within your club that your club pays is recorded in the accounting system and reported to members. And not just reported to members, but reported to the board against budgets. So if you're expecting $50 to be paid to the butcher and you had $500 to be paid to the butcher, then that should be reported to the board as saying, hey, there's a variance of $450 here. That's a bit strange. We needed to have an explanation. Now, 99 times out of 100, that explanation will be absolutely fine. But it could be that we're siphoning money off to the butcher in untoward circumstances.
The next one is particularly close to my heart. It was a continual bugbear when I was on the committee of a soccer club, and it's because when we talk assets, the club volunteers don't actually see them as assets. They just see them as expendable items. And we're talking medical supplies, we're talking kit, we're talking bar supplies, we're talking sports equipment. How many times at the end of a year are you part of a club and you go and have a look at what equipment is coming back, and you're just missing all this type of equipment? And at the end of the day, I think clubs need to realise that it costs them money, so we need to protect them.
Well, absolutely, Joe. The canteen, the bar, the medical supplies, the sports equipment, and you know, your facility maintenance equipment are effectively cash. And so for a small senior football club, they would spend over $10,000 just on strapping tape. And we've walked into clubs where we see, you know, reams and piles of strapping tape. Well, that's a lot of money just sitting there unsecured in bar sales and alcohol sales. So protect the assets of your club is just as important as protecting the cash and limiting people's access to it, and also limiting the amount of that we hold on stock in the club rooms unsupervised.
And keeping tabs on the assets that you have is an extension of that, and that makes up point number eight, which is ensuring records of assets are kept.
Oh, how can you protect something if you don't know that you've got it? So we do need to know what assets that we've got, and when we're talking assets, Joe, we're predominantly talking equipment and bar supplies and medical supplies and canteen supplies and our facility maintenance, whether it be chemicals for the pool, fertilizer for the ground, those sorts of things. Like, if we don't know what we've got, if we don't know that we've got 10 cricket bats,
How do we know when there's one missing?
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, the next one is one that could potentially open an absolute Pandora's box, and that is keeping tabs of equipment that's been lent out to members. And you'd all of you out there involved in sports clubs would know this one, you know, take this home, and then if you don't keep tabs on that, it becomes a, oh, did you, have you got that one? Oh, I can't remember taking it. Where
ice
is it?
Ice packs and those sorts of things.
And it just becomes a whole world of problems. People get accused of stealing when they didn't, and you just don't want to have this kind of issue at your club. So the ensure that your equipment lent to members is tracked and checked.
And received back. Yeah, and much the same way that libraries track their library books. You know, keep a register of what they've got, who's got it, and when it's due back. And then when it does come back, sign off on it. So Joe, there are nine tips to control, well, nine ways of looking to control and protect not just the cash and the assets of the club, but the people that are handling the cash and the assets. So hope that helps.
Okay, we're rapidly coming to that time again, the end of the show. It's been a pleasure hosting the radio show for you out there this week. We hope that you've enjoyed it. So on behalf of myself, Joe Novella,
and myself, Steve Pellis, thank you for having us part of your sports community.